Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney, Chair of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Impact Investing. Invest and improve the world with your portfolio, endowments, and foundations. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for the evening. Paul Herman, CEO of HIP Investors Rating Portfolios, Ardith Neal, President of Heifer Foundation, an international philanthropic foundation supporting Heifer International, Rodrigo Davis, Chief Product Officer at Neighborly.com, the online Munibond platform, and Ian Monroe, co-founder of Etho Capital, a sustainable investing company with an ETF on the New York Stock Exchange. And now to Paul. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us this evening, and really excited to hear your questions and interactivity when we get there. The panel's going to dig in for at least 30 minutes or so. Do I need to repeat myself? For at least 30 minutes or so. And so we have a series of questions to get started so you can get to know us. Get to know how we're focused on impact investing, how to use our capital to create a better world. And in the context, if you're familiar with foundations or endowments, those foundations and endowments have to give away 5% every year in the forms of grants, but now can do that in the forms of debt or equity even. And sometimes you might think about your portfolio as a foundation or endowment or an individual by saying, I'm going to make as much money as I can, and I'm going to give the most away to nonprofits. And what that means is if your portfolio is not having a positive impact but having a negative impact, 95% of your money is creating problems and only 5% of it is solving problems. So what you're going to hear today are how to get 100% of your money to work for 100% of society, not just the 1%, but the 99%. And so we're going to dig into some of those issues. So thanks very much to our panel. And I will also, you may hear me speak on behalf of Dr. Robert Johnson, who as of late last night went from being president of Becker College to chancellor of the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. So he sends his regrets for not being here, but we'll be able to talk about how Becker College has become one of the first college endowments to go 100% impact-oriented in their portfolio. So first, we're just going to do a quick name and role and sort of how we came to impact. Then we're going to talk about the missions of our respective organizations. We'll talk about why we've done that and what the goals are, how we got there and sort of lessons learned. And then we're going to talk about the future, 2020 and 2050, when I'll be 82. So, Ardith, you don't have to tell us how old you'll be in 2050, but who are you? What's your role and how did you come to being focused on impact investing personally?
All right. I'm Ardith Neal. I'm the president of Heifer Foundation, and we are the foundation for Heifer International. Our role is to grow an endowment for their ongoing support. So for me, when I first took on this role, I looked at our mission statement, and our mission statement is to grow an endowment for the ongoing support of Heifer International. And the support word resonated with me. And to me, that didn't mean just the income we were giving every year. It's also how we invest those funds and why can't we invest those funds to have positive impact not only in our regular portfolio but also on the communities Heifer's working in. And so that is what my goal has been and we've been driving towards, and it's still a journey. We're still in the early stages, but we're making progress. So,
great. Welcome, Ian.
Great to be here. So Ian Monroe, and one hat is I teach courses on sustainability metrics and climate solutions scale-up at Stanford University. And the more recent hat is I also help run Etho Capital, that's creating sustainable investment funds. And I have a long, windy road into all this. I'll try to give you a very abbreviated life story. Grew up on a little sustainable farm in Mendocino County, so a bit north of here, with a lot of back-to-the-lander hippie folks doing sustainable food and off-grid renewable energy long before that stuff was cool. Went on to then study that and work in international development for more than a decade, sometimes alongside great organizations like HEFR, working at this point in more than 30 countries on scaling up solutions to climate change and renewable energy, and eventually got an invitation to come back to Stanford and start teaching courses on the subject, and increasingly began to see that one of the biggest missing pieces is getting our financial system re-incentivized to move these massive pools of capital that are currently invested in many of the companies most connected to the problems connected to climate change and shift that money into solutions and realize that one of the ways to do that is just to show that making that shift from problem into solution can be more profitable. So that's a big piece of what I spend my time on now with Etho Capital.
Great. Welcome. Rodrigo?
Yeah, hi. I'm Rodrigo Davies, Chief Product Officer of Neighbourly. We're a platform for investing in municipal bonds. So we're also a municipal broker-dealer. So we enable cities and public agencies to raise money for infrastructure projects, much as they would with a conventional Wall Street firm in one sense. But the big difference is we enable anybody to invest in those projects, make them much more accessible. And my sort of story and kind of coming into impact, I guess, is a mixture of finance, technology, and community development. So I was a financial journalist for about 6 years at Bloomberg and the BBC, then got into sort of technology products. And out of that, began to sort of research how technology products could be applied to problems of community development. And as someone who grew up in the UK's equivalent of the Rust Belt in Wales, I became fascinated in how local decision-making and local financial models can be a really important improvement on central systems that are not working as they should. So that sort of led me to graduate research at MIT and at Stanford here. And I was in a PhD when Neighbourly was getting started and put that on hold to do what I'm doing now. And that was sort of 2.5 years ago. And you know, haven't really looked back since then.
All right. So we'll informally call you Dr. Rodrigo.
Nice.
Great. And I'm Paul Herman. I'm the founder and CEO of HIP Investor. HIP stands for Human Impact and Profit. And we think of transforming the financial markets by intersecting self-interest and group interest. Self-interest through profit and group interest through impact. And that every dollar in the investment world, there's more than $200 trillion of capital worldwide, and there's a fraction of that in donations worldwide, that every stock, bond, mutual fund, ETF, and 401k plan can invest in a way that benefits society instead of being extractive out of society. So a mix of my background is I have a Wharton finance degree, so I know how to speak about sharp ratios and alpha. I worked at McKinsey, so I saw firsthand how boards of directors make decisions, which sometimes aren't always the most focused on fiduciary duty. I've started a company with my wife, Mrs. Hip, who's here, that focused on kids and teens and how they use their money in a parental permission environment to shop, bank, invest, and donate. And then I've worked at Ashoka, supporting social entrepreneurs in 60 countries around the world that solve health, environmental, and civil rights issues. And then before starting HIP 11 years ago, worked for the founder of eBay, who has allocated his money to investing in for-profits that build a better world, contributing to nonprofits that do that, and influence the politics, especially in human rights. Pam Omidyar, his wife, as well as Pierre. So what we do at HIP is essentially, and I'll bridge into part two of the question, is the mission of our organization is to transform capital markets so that it works for all of us, so it merges self-interest and group interest for 100% of society, and that individual investors as well as institutional investors can do that. So our products are 32,000 investment ratings of 6,000 companies globally and 26,000 muni bonds on are they being empowering of society, of people, of natural resources and trust, or are they being extractive? And what may not surprise you conceptually, but may pain you personally, is most of your portfolio is probably in things that are being extractive of people, not paying them enough, maybe overpaying the CEO, being extractive of the environment, overusing oil and water and polluting the environment, and extractive of trust, just not being transparent. And so you have the ability to change that in your own portfolio and to go 100% impact. So we're going to learn more about how you might do that. Great. So Ardith, Heffer Foundation has chosen to go that direction. So what is the mission of Heffer, including ending poverty, and how does that relate to voting with your investment dollars, not just your grant dollars?
That's right. I said the mission of the foundation is to grow an endowment for Heffer International. Well, Heffer International's mission is to end hunger and poverty and care for the earth. We work in 28 countries with smallholder farmers to that goal. And so not only are we looking at our overall portfolio and how we invest in regular stocks and fixed income portfolios, which we just changed so that we've gone from nothing with an ESG tilt to 67% of the portfolio has an ESG tilt.
And ESG is environmental, social governance.
Right. Activities. And that happened with just two manager changes within the overall portfolio. It did not take much to be able to do that. We're just 3 months in, so it's still early. But the last quarter results for that quarter were very well. Very good. And that's been the concern of the board is how do we do this? Because boards are supposed to invest your endowment funds so that the mission of the organizations you support can make their happening. But with the extractive activities, it's a net zero activity in that regard. So this is great for the portfolio, but I really have pushed us to think about it a step further. What can we do with these communities and these smallholder farmers? These smallholder farmers are coming together and putting together small agribusinesses and cooperatives with the help of Heffer's work with them. And it's animal-based agriculture. So in Africa, it's dairy production and it's milk hubs. Well, so let's look at the total market value chain and what are the barriers for them having a bigger piece of that pie, so to speak? How do they have more income from that overall value chain? What are the barriers and what can we do to help link them into that? Well, what we found is the biggest problem these farmers have is they have no working capital and no one will loan them money. And if they do get loans, it's from what they call, in Mexico, they call them coyotes. And to harvest coffee, they have to hire folks to help them do that. So these coyotes charge them 8% a month for the funds. Well, that's bad enough. Then when it comes time to pay these coyotes back, the coyotes set the price and take the coffee, not the cash. So how do you break that cycle? How do we break that cycle of poverty when that's the situation they're living in? So we are in conversations with Root Capital, which does this type of investing, to see how we can work together to loan funds at a reasonable rate to these cooperatives so that they can have better income to the farmers, more productive life, get them to a living income, break that poverty cycle. For the foundation, we can invest, get a small return, but the impact of those dollars that we've invested, we believe we're going to show is multiple times more impactful than the little bit of money that we're not getting from the return, because those lives are being changed in those communities. And that's what's exciting for me right now, because I don't only think it changes the way we invest, it also can change the way development is done globally and here in the U.S. So it's exciting times.
So you would be the banker as the foundation as well.
We would invest through Root Capital, and they would be the banker, and then they will pay us returns based on their work in those communities because they have the structures in place and the legal structures in place to be able to function that way. It's very difficult to get those legal structures in every country. So by collaborating with others, which takes time and energy, we can make a bigger difference.
Great. And are you able to say how much you might allocate to that?
Right now, the initial fund we're looking at would be, we believe the foundation can put in $1 million. They can leverage that by another three, so it'd be a $4 million fund. Right. The foundation right now has $10 million set aside to start looking in this direction, to actually investing in this type of opportunity. We're also talking with Microvest on some other options there as well.
And $10 million, if you're able to say, is what percent of the overall portfolio?
The total foundation endowment right now is at $78
million. Okay.
So, and the total assets are $109 million.
Right. Okay, so somewhere between 8 and 12% of a foundation portfolio can be allocated to something that can generate a financial return with an impact. And so if you're involved in foundations at all, that could be a question for your next board meeting, or if you're a donor to them, to ask them, hey, how might the mission of our foundation or nonprofit or endowment do the same thing at the same time? Okay, so who wants to go next? Rodrigo, do you want to, how does that fit? Like, is the people who use Neighbourly, are they individuals? Are they bond traders? Are they institutional investors? And what's their goal for impact?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing a sort of a range. In my intro, you know, I talked about the thing that has differentiated us has been the fact that we're giving individual investors access to an asset class that they just haven't been able to access very easily in the past. And for those individuals, we see a lot of folks very clearly expressing that the reason they want to buy municipal bonds is because they want to have an impact in their own community or in communities where they have some affinity. So maybe they have family there or they went to school there and so on. But increasingly, the interest that we're getting is from institutional investors who are saying, you know, these municipal bond projects actually can be mapped very effectively to sort of ESG criteria that they have. And there are some really interesting organizations starting to do that mapping, including HIP. HIP's obviously one of the pioneers there. But I think we're just at the beginning of kind of understanding that this 200-year-old market that funds, you know, our nation's places, built the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, you name it, any pretty large national landmark or city landmark was probably funded by bonds. Folks are just now waking up to the fact that this is something we could be participating in and having impact locally. And rather than sort of all of the investing being kind of opaque and sort of fragmented, it can actually be something really tangible that you do on a local level. So, for example, if you live in San Francisco and you have a family and you send your children to a San Francisco Unified School District school, why not be able to buy the bonds of the school district? It just seems like a natural sort of fit. So I think the motivations are very much coming from that place of impact, even though the sort of vehicle perhaps isn't the, you know, something that conventionally has been regarded as impact investing.
And is there something individual investors can do, everyday investors can do to participate in that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, with you know, the cities that we work with, you know, have the ability to restrict who invests. So some cities will just want folks from the city to be first in line. Others will make it, you know, much more open. So, for example, we're doing a project with Burlington, Vermont in a couple of weeks where the use of proceeds is around, some of it is around public spaces and how to revitalize a waterfront, for example. So if you're somebody who really cares about that issue, perhaps you've, you know, worked in planning or something, or you have a project like that you'd like to see happen locally, you can vote with your dollars and support that project in that sense. So I think, you know, governments are really seeing that the work that they do is super vital, but they're not necessarily in the habit of sort of telling the really positive story. of the investments that are being made and the facilities that are being provided. But local residents really want to hear that story. And so what we're just trying to do is say, look, this work is already going on. You just don't know about it. And if we can connect those two sides, then the borrower and the lender essentially have a shared interest. Right.
And in some cases, most people think, oh, my money is going to a city or a school district. That's positive. But in some cases, but not all cities are well managed, or not all school districts might be well managed. So how does somebody tell that?
Yeah, so I mean, that's where sort of the kinds of metrics that like HIP and others are producing become really important. So you can dig into like what is the governance of something. You don't just have to take the word of other credit agencies for it. I think getting to a place of having really robust criteria around ESG at the local level, it's going to take. There's going to be a few stages to get to that, because to have the metrics and have the infrastructure to monitor them, is no easy task for a city.
Right. So this is something that would take a lot of time and dedication to do. But for example, Washington, D.C. just issued an environmental impact bond, and they've essentially sent a band of how much wastewater they're going to save from overflows. And there's a reward or penalty if they do a good or bad job related to that. So that's actually the Washington, D.C. Water utility. All right. So, Ian, you have an exchange-traded fund, like a mutual fund, but an exchange-traded fund on New York Stock Exchange. So how did that happen? You're not Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan or UBS. How did that come to be?
It's certainly been a journey. And my personal mission is doing everything that I can to scale up solutions to climate change. And with finance being one of the vehicles for that, Etho Capital's mission is really showing that you can create investment funds that fulfill all the sustainability criteria you're looking for, but actually go beyond just doing something because it's right for people on the planet to using sustainability data to just help identify better companies that make better investments. And so everything we're doing with Etho Capital really is focused on this idea that sustainability actually can just help us be better investors overall in terms of financial returns as well as social and environmental returns. And what we have with the Etho ETF on the New York Stock Exchange, which has been up for about a year and a half now, is basically a cleaner, greener, more socially responsible version of the S&P 500. But it's one that we've really created from the bottom up, where globally we look at about, these are all public equities we're invested in, so publicly traded companies, small to large cap. Globally, we're looking at about 6,000 companies, and we're doing the kind of more traditional sustainable investing negative screens to remove all fossil fuel companies, to remove weapons companies, tobacco companies, private prisons, many of the other categories that generally are industries that are just considered inherently socially irresponsible. Certainly, we can have debates about that, but the bigger piece of our process is trying to identify out of who everybody else that we potentially want to invest in, all the other sectors out there, technology, healthcare, consumer products, who really are the leaders. And that's a big piece of what's gone into creating what we call the Climate Leadership Index, which is the basis of this Etho ETF on the New York Stock Exchange. So it's taking out the bad stuff, and then out of what remains, which is the vast majority, trying to figure out who really are the leaders in each industry. And
what are those metrics? How do you determine a leader?
That's the biggest challenge. And mm-hmm. I think it's something we're all struggling with. And this is something that goes into the courses on sustainability metrics that I teach at Stanford as well. As much as possible, we're trying to go beyond what companies say about themselves. And that's what a lot of the traditional ESG metrics have been based on. Is basically companies are considered good actors if they put out corporate social responsibility reports saying how great they are. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of standardization and certainly very little third-party verification and auditing of those corporate social responsibility reports. And the only companies that are putting out those reports tend to be the big companies because they have enough money to have staff dedicated to doing that. So smaller companies, mid-cap companies, they tend not to do that. And we're trying to, as much as we can, go beyond this self-reported CSR world of sustainability, which is really just rating companies based on how good they are about saying good things about themselves. Because surprise, surprise, when a company puts out a CSR report, which is generally controlled by its marketing department, it usually is saying nice things about itself. Yeah.
CSR is corporate social responsibility.
Indeed.
And just as a refresher, ESG is environmental social governance.
And we will try to keep the acronym SOUP as unsoupy as possible in all this. But there's we can dive very deep into many acronyms in this world, as I'm sure you guys have started.
But just as an example, so like Apple Computer has a very low greenhouse gas emission ratio relative to its revenue. But part of the reason is they're not counting everything in the supply chain. They're not counting Foxconn and all the other electronics.
So the kind of analysis we do does actually count all that. Mm-hmm. And so we look beyond just what a company is doing directly with, say, burning fossil fuels on site and their electricity use, to getting better, at least modeled estimates of what's embodied in all the things in their supply chain, the steel they're using, the water they're using, the copper they're using, semi-finished products. And Apple actually, in the technology center sector, comes out looking relatively good. We also, one of the examples we toss out a lot to distinguish our methodology for how we're trying to sort out who really are the leaders versus who just say they're leaders, is Tesla versus Volkswagen, where Volkswagen is a company that for more than a decade has been fantastic at putting out CSR reports, saying how great it is as a company, and has actually won many awards for supposedly being a sustainability leader. But as I'm sure all of you know who've been following the news, of course, they were lying about their emissions and deliberately doing things.
Alternative facts.
Cheated the emissions alternative fact testing system, right? So Volkswagen, now it's coming out that they're not actually a particularly sustainable company. We have looked at over 10 years of data to look at what we call the climate efficiency, the total greenhouse gas pollution, including all that stuff embodied in the supply chain, per dollar invested for Volkswagen versus other automakers. And if you look at what companies are actually doing by modeling that on how they're spending their money, not what they say in their CSR reports, Volkswagen comes out as one of the least sustainable automakers. Tesla, on the other hand, is a company that still is relatively small and not putting out great corporate social responsibility reports saying how great they are on a regular basis. They probably should be. And that's one of Paul's jobs, is to keep needling them to get better about it. And we're trying to help there as well. So Tesla, in a lot of scoring systems historically, hasn't done very well because they're not putting out reports saying how great they are. Again, when we look at data that's modeling their impacts based on how they're spending their money compared with other automakers, they actually come out as one of the leaders in the industry. And you probably would expect Tesla to be a leader in the industry, but a company that at times has been in our climate leadership index that maybe you wouldn't expect, that actually is also a relatively climate efficient automaker, is Harley Davidson. But they're not a company that would ever market themselves that way, because it's a little bit the antithesis of the macho Harley image, right, that's out there.
But so it also depends on what your impact is. So if you think of climate, you might look to Tesla or SolarCity. Harley Davidson also lied, just like Volkswagen did. But if you said, okay, well, what's important to me is women, and so today is Women's Day, and several of us are wearing red or honoring women. And so if you look at gender diversity at Tesla and some of the tech companies, then they don't have a high proportion of women on the board or women in leadership and the like. So what's important for you from your own impact perspective is how you want to vote with your money. So you may, if climate action is the number one thing and the survival of us on the planet, then climate leadership is one. If building up income among people all around the world, then you might choose a heifer-like mission of economic development and income growth. If sustainable cities is one, then you might choose some of the profiles that have won the Neighborly Challenge in Austin, Texas, and Burlington, Vermont, and Cambridge, Massachusetts. And if you choose women, then there's investment products for that as well. So how to reward companies that are led by women, who, by the way, on average, companies with more women on the board outperform companies with less or even no women on the board. And there's actually 800 public companies worldwide that have zero women on the board. And those have lagging financial performance and higher risk. So an important thing as we talk about the how-to here is like what's important to you and what's important to the organizations, your foundation, your endowment, your school's endowment. So unfortunately, Dr. Johnson wasn't able to be here, but one of the things Becker College has done is not only land a Muhammad Yunus Social Business Center. So Muhammad Yunus is the Nobel Prize winner fostering microfinance around the world. He's now helping students, creating centers so that universities can teach students how to create these enterprises that have both impact and profit at the same time. And so what Becker's doing is they're not only doing that for the endowment of the Yunus Social Business Center, they're doing that for the endowment of Becker College. And in conjunction with their investment advisor, who's Morgan Stanley, and this is something I actually work with them on as HIP, is to point, like Ardith described, take the public equities and point them to better companies, and in the best case, sustainable companies, and to start to create a portion of the portfolio, and Ardith spoke to this as well, that's locally invested. So Becker graduates nurses. They graduate experts in animal science. They graduate game designers. So Google hires from Becker College, their top 10 school in game designers. And so a part of the endowment in the future can go to funding those, funding students and alumni's ventures, as well as local social enterprises or even renewable energy. So what we're trying to do is paint a catalog for you of different ways you can do this. Each of you are unique. You're passionate about particular impacts. You have at least one, or I'll bet most of us in this room are systems thinkers and multi-generational thinkers. So by picking what metrics you want to attach to those portfolios, then you can put start to ask those probing questions like Ardith and Heffer did of their investment consultants and their fund managers. All right, so get ready with your questions. We're going to allow you to empower you to ask some good, tough questions, hopefully constructive, but meant to educate not us, but the podcast listeners. So let's just talk for a minute about the challenges and then about the future. So Ardith, what's like the number one challenge in getting this done? Is it a technical problem or a human problem?
For us, it's been more of a human problem. It's getting the collaborative parties together and coming up with answers that really catapult this forward. It's also been a journey with the board of Heffer Foundation to move this way because these funds are entrusted to us, and they take their fiduciary responsibilities, as they should, very seriously. So moving in this direction, whether it's more tilted towards ESG or true investments in the communities that we work, it's unknown territory and it's riskier. And so how do we balance that, and how do they balance that and feel comfortable with the fiduciary responsibility? So that's been a challenge, but we've been, due to great work of others, we can see that you don't have to give up returns to have ESG in your portfolio. And just because we give up a little return, we can still protect our principal and have greater impact on the world. And what really we're all doing in this environment, especially from a foundation that supports a nonprofit, is wanting to have the impact to change the world. And so we've got to have good impact measures to be able to do that as well.
Great. And is there one or two impact metrics that are focused?
Right now we're focusing on living income. Our goal is to raise 4 million families to a living income by 2020, and that's a huge goal. And whether we make it or not is important, but it's not been as important as the way we rethink our work and we rethink how we work in these communities and what metrics we need to collect in those communities in order to be able to show that we've done that.
Great. Rodrigo, who are the investors that say yes easily, and who are the investors that take some persuading?
I think the ones who say yes easily are, folks who maybe have participated in the bond market before, and immediately understand what it's all about, and folks who are completely new. For example, so folks in their 30s or early 40s who may be the first generation of their family to have accumulated significant wealth, and they, you know, they want to do something besides just investing in the S&P 500. They care about, you know, investing in their community. So they say yes easily, I would say. Those who don't are the folks to whom investing in your community is just completely opaque. You know, one of the biggest challenges is the sort of financial literacy challenge. So you have a market that has become, like many others, more and more consolidated over the last, you know, 3 or 4 decades, a place where fees and commissions are much higher than they need to be. And, you know, the sort of practice of issuing and investing is based on cost structures that are honestly pretty outdated. And the people who pay the bill are, on the one side, the cities and therefore our tax dollars. And then on the other side, investors who aren't, you know, very well informed. And so, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in educating and supporting folks. There's no shortage of appetite for investing in a positive way. But the channels and the ways to take action aren't always clear.
Got it. All right. And Ian, who are your core, what are the psychographics or demographics of the people who choose this and of the skeptics?
So the short answer is we hope this becomes something that everybody can choose. And this is one of the reasons we're doing what we're doing first as an exchange-traded fund, as the ETHO ETF, is because that allows us to have relatively low management fees and trading on the New York Stock Exchange. And we now actually have a second ETF trading on the Sydney Stock Exchange in Australia. The ETHO ETF is essentially as easy to buy as any other fund or any publicly listed company, any stock. And it's also just as liquid. So you can buy it just as easily as you can sell it. The minimum share price is around $29 right now. And so you buy a share and you're buying about 370 companies that are climate and overall sustainability leaders here in the US. And now we're working on these international funds as well. And so our goal is to really bring sustainable investing to everyone and show that you can do so without sacrificing returns, which, knock on wood, past performance can never guarantee future returns is the standard lawyer line. But so far, we've been substantially ahead of the S&P since we launched about a year and a half ago. And we're getting everyone from college students buying the ETF to large institutional endowments. So we're essentially as accessible to a college student that's rousing on the door for their university to divest from fossil fuels and invest in sustainable solutions as we are to their university endowment managers or big public pension fund managers. And we're trying to help mainstream sustainable investing by having solutions for everybody.
Got it. And Ardith, I'm looking at your notebook here. Does that say that fees went down by doing something in this way?
Yes. Our fees have gone from 0.6% to 0.32%.
Almost half.
Almost half.
So how did that happen? That's by doing something more unique. How did you get lower fees?
It's thank goodness for good investment consultants like Morgan Stanley that are negotiating on our behalf, but also because the fees have gone down. The managers that we're working with are not only performing better, they're charging less.
Great. And is part of that, not to get too technical, is part of that because it's in separately managed accounts versus mutual funds, or?
These are still primarily separately managed accounts.
Okay. So separately managed accounts, so you understand, are things that, I don't want to misstate this, it's like a mutual fund, but you own the stocks directly. And so you're paying a manager to manage it instead of in a big pool. They're managing it like a big pool, but customized to you. So if one person wants to exclude a certain type of company, they're working on the same model, and they can customize it to you. And at least on the Morgan Stanley platform, those are lower fees than mutual funds sometimes. So you may need to have more money, you know, as a high net worth investor, but that's something that if you have, again, an endowment, a foundation, or a family office, that you could do. Okay, so what we heard so far is you can do this. across any type of investment. You can do it in cash, like at a new resource bank or a beneficial state bank or a credit union. You can do it in muni bonds, which Rodrigo has talked about, and Neighbourly is one of the ways that you can do that. You can do it in public equities, not only in ETHO for climate leadership. There's a company called PAX Elevate that has a women's focus fund. There's a company called Parnassus that has a great place to work for fund. So there's an increasing number of choices that you have, including in real estate and sustainable real estate, as well as private equity and venture capital. So the catalog of choices is increasing, so it's up to you. It's up to you and to, one, to declare it's your money. It's not the financial advisor's money, it's your money. And if you don't find an advisor or a fund manager or a 401k plan, then it's up to you to vote with your money and either to move your money or to keep the pressure up. And the good financial advisors and good fund managers, they just jumped at the opportunity to do it, right, Ardith? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the ones who listen are the ones who are going to be in business in the future, and the ones who don't listen, your money might have other risks if they're not listening to you. So, all right, so get your questions ready. This is our last tee up before the Q&A. What does the future of investing look like in, you know, as soon as 2020? So in the near term, during this new political era. And what does it look like in 2050? So who would like to go?
Sure, yeah, happy to dive in. I think 2020, we're looking at least from where I sit, cities, public agencies being able to raise money for critical infrastructure at much lower cost, and folks from every community being able to invest in projects that impact them directly. 2050, I think we're talking about cities and public agencies and other folks being able to raise money for infrastructure at a very small scale, very rapidly on an as-needed basis, and folks being able to organize locally to raise money for infrastructure and the services that they need, and for the sort of legal constructs and things that right now feel kind of cumbersome to be something at their fingertips.
Great. Who would like to go next?
I suppose I'll dive in. I think I'll start with 2017. The nearest term thing that we're really excited about is to really try to bring a crowdsourced sustainability expertise voice into the process. So we're in the process of actually launching a tech platform through OroEco, which is a personal sustainability gamification platform that brought me into what I do with Etho Capital, where we'll essentially have a Yelp or Glassdoor like for sustainability rating system, where anybody in the public and sustainability experts out of nonprofits, academia, current or former company employees can participate in an ongoing dialogue about what companies are really doing, not just what they're saying in their corporate social responsibility reports. And we're going to make that free and open source and accessible to everyone around the world who has an internet connection. In 2020, I'm hoping that we get to the stage where a lot of these sustainable investment products, whether they're public equities like what we're doing with Etho ETF or bond products, or really innovative community finance projects around the world, have enough of a track record that they can check that every fiduciary duty box for every sized investor, with a whole lot of the large institutional investors requiring a 3-year track record. With Etho Capital and the Etho ETF, we have about a year and a half. So we're halfway there showing that you can do this with strong financial performance, but a lot of investors won't really believe us till we've done it for another year and a half. I think by 2020, we'll definitely have all that evidence there, and we'll get to the point that sustainable investing is starting to mainstream, where we're dispelling this myth that if you're going more sustainable, you're necessarily going to be making less money. There's plenty of evidence, not just what we've seen with the Etho ETF, but coming out of academic research at Oxford, Harvard, Stanford, many other places, showing that actually smarter sustainability metrics incorporated into investing on average makes more money than conventional approaches that ignore sustainability. I think by 2020, we'll be hitting that point. By 2050, I'm hoping that we will have flipped all of this on its head to the point that we're not even talking about sustainable investing, that it just becomes investing. And this a little bit cliche to say in this space, but I think that is the direction we're moving in, particularly sustainability metrics that are showing a strong connection with financial performance. The more we prove that out, the more it then changes the fiduciary conversation to the starting point that we can't do sustainable investing because we'll sacrifice returns and therefore we're failing our fiduciary obligations, to actually going with the reality, which is no, many of these sustainability metrics, like women in leadership, for example, and we're seeing climate efficiency, overall operational efficiency, and better, more innovative management decision-making all connected. These kind of metrics just relate to identifying better companies that are better investments, that are better positioned for the future, changing technologies, changing risks. And it's just considered something that you have to do as an investor, is take all this stuff into account, and we're all doing it, and we don't really need to talk about it anymore.
Ardith?
And I agree. I really think by 2020, we're going to, a lot of these instruments that are in place now are going to have checked all those boxes. We're going to know that we've achieved all those fiduciary responsibilities that we as investors have to have, especially when we're investing funds that are publicly entrusted to us. So I think that's coming. I think there's a lot of things that have been happening over the last 3-4 years that by 2020 we're going to have that track record that's going to be able to show all of that. And I really believe within 30 years, by 2050, it is going to be, it's just going to be norm. There isn't going to be these conversations, should we, shouldn't we, why didn't we, why couldn't we. It's going to be, this is just what we do. But I also think by then we're also going to see this type of investing is going to change the way development work and other work is being done to help individuals help themselves, because this is what they need in order to do that, and we'll prove that it works. So it's not only going to be a financial return, but there'll be a much greater 200-fold would be lovely, difference in the world in which we live because of the way we've invested in individuals that make their lives and their communities' lives better.
And that 200-fold is the 200x of donations to capital markets. So that's it's a totally reasonable, achievable metric. Okay, get your questions ready. In 2017, this is the year of the fossil-free portfolio and the fossil-free 401k. You can see what mutual funds are fossil-free if you go to fossilfreefunds.org. That's a website from As You Sow, which is a nonprofit around shareholder advocacy. And this is something you can do in your 401k today and challenge your 401k manager and even add models inside your 401k where you can invest in that way. So so that's one. Two is 2020 is really, by that time, you will have the ability on any website as a personalized portal or app to have a personalized impact allocation. Not just an asset allocation of stocks and bonds and real estate, but an impact allocation. I care about women. I care about climate action. I care about level income around the world. And so that's something that we're launching this year, is this personalized fintech portal to be able to tune to your exact values and goals. And then 2050, this is the dream, and I hope it happens sooner than 2050, we will have achieved true accountability in capital markets. And so accountability for a particular impact. If you invest in a K-12 school district and it does not deliver the education outcomes for the students, that that school district will be accountable for a penalty for doing a misservice to the kids. That if the water utility spills overflows water from the sewage utility, that there'll be a penalty for that. And that if they do a great job, then investors will pay more for it. And they'll compete for, just like they compete for financial returns today, they'll compete for impact. So we like to talk about this as like capital markets with teeth. And the real teeth isn't just the promised financial return, it's the promised impact. And the challenge to get there in 2050 is that humans don't like to be accountable. unless forced to be. So it's up to us. It's up to us to unify, be a coalition. Think of the old labor unions or cooperatives, for us to unify in our power, to be one coalition, to speak with a voice about impact, and to be able to apply that to financial markets. All right, who's got questions? There's a mic at the back. It's wireless in case you want to poke it around.
As you line up, I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we are listening to Paul Herman, Ardith Neal, Rodrigo Davis, and Ian Moore, Monroe, who are with us today on the subject of impact investing. Invest and improve the world with your portfolio, endowments, and foundations.
Okay, we're ready for questions. Please use the mic if you have one. Some people had a 7 o'clock dinner, it looks like.
It seems like a no-brainer.
It seems like a no-brainer that an organization like Heifer would use their large endowment to help further their mission. I'm curious if you know how many organizations are doing that, because I had not really heard of it before. And if somebody in this audience is interested or involved in a foundation or contributes to a charity that is not doing it, how can we help convince them that this makes a whole lot of sense to really multiply their mission many times?
Thank you. I'm not sure how many folks are moving that way. I do know that it is a large movement within the foundation communities. We're actually a member of the Mission Investors Exchange, which are a large number of charity groups, various foundations, community foundations, private family foundations that are working together to look at this and how we can do it. And Heron Foundation has set the bar for all of us, and we're all watching them and learning from them.
Yeah.
Those are great.
Yeah, if you go to FB Heron, Frank Boy Heron, HERON.org, and they've invested in something called Sustainable Jobs Fund, SJF, three different times. The first time as a grant, they granted money to a venture capital fund. The second time is what's called a PRI, program-related investment. So using the grant money, they made it an equity investment, which then got replenished, the endowment. And then the third time out of their endowment as a for-profit investment. All right, next question.
Thank you. So we are here because we are believers. We want to believe in this. So I wonder if you can give me reasons why we shouldn't do this.
All right, good question. Ian, you had asked for this. Why shouldn't you do it?
Why shouldn't you? I honestly don't see any good reason not to, just because there are the full spectrum of different types of investments that fit into the sustainability space that anybody would want right now. It's really just a matter of looking hard enough. And if you're working with an external financial advisor, making sure that they're looking hard enough on your behalf. I think the track record is there. Sustainable investment options are like any other investment option. You have some that are outperforming the market, some that are underperforming the market. On average, there are a lot of studies showing that they're outperforming the market at least a bit. But there are certainly some bad ones out there, too. I've done a lot in the clean technology space, for example, and solar and wind. And there were a lot of early stage clean tech investors out of Silicon Valley who thought that clean tech worked the same way that traditional software tech worked, and invested in a lot of companies at a really early stage, not realizing that these are actually extremely capital intensive markets with a lot of regulatory red tape to cut through. And it's really hard to survive, particularly when you're competing with a bunch of, say, cheap solar panel manufacturers that are highly subsidized in China. So I'd say, you know, like anything else, really take a good look, buyer beware, have a sense of if you're going to do some sort of concentrated investing, like investing in clean tech only, really knowing what you're doing in the lay of the land with the market. What we're doing with Etho Capital and the Etho ETF is really a replacement for just investing in the overall U.S. stock market. The ETF goes up when the market goes up, tends to go down when the market goes down, and we're seeing some outperformance there, but it essentially moves with the market. So if you think the market is really overvalued right now and is going to go down, then like with any other investment in the stock market, there's a concern there. So there, that just idea around context and timing and really knowing what you're invested in, making sure you're fully diversified, certainly applies to this space as much as any other investment.
This is a really great question. So I'll give you two that hopefully will answer your question. You might say, well, maybe I should invest in oil and gas companies in the next 3 years, given what the U.S. federal government is doing. So that's one reason why you may not do it sooner. But if you have a long-term portfolio, the question will be, when that era ends, will the prices be higher or lower versus doing it today? And how will you feel about being invested in that way the next 3 years? The second one is why not to do it is you might get your financial advisor or fund manager or 401k, they might say, oh, this is ridiculous. Why do you want to lose money? And so it might be embarrassing to ask about it. And so that's why some people might choose not to do it. But like any human right, civil right, if we don't advocate for it now, and if we don't do it, how are we going to get people to follow us? So it's really a question, do you want to be a leader or a follower or a fast follower? So those are some reasons why you might not do it. Next question.
May I first thank all four of you for an excellent presentation, different perspectives, and for clearly the passion and responsibility that comes forth with this. So thank you very much. I'm a really naive investor, and I have a lot of belief. And so my question, if we use Heifer as an example, is how are you all going to monitor for the law of unintended consequences? Which relates to not only, you know, I love the idea of investing with individuals. I'm familiar with a little bit of Heifer's missions along with other foundations and NGO activities. And so how do you monitor the effectiveness of this when you, on the ground, have to take into account that there will also be money flows that will be attractive to the local governments, the local organizations of loan sharks, and the larger governments at large? And will therefore the impact be positive for the individual farmer or actually endanger the individual farmer?
That is a wonderful question and one that we are asking internally right now as we look at this. We don't have good answers yet because it's still new space. But it is important to us to know and to think about that as we do these work. With Heifer's work, so much of it is community-driven and social impact, raising social capital within because of the value training we do, the holistic value training. And we found in the studies we've done of those communities so far that social capital alleviates some of that, but not all of it, because governments are going to be governments, and individuals are going to be individuals, and there's always going to be some negative consequences. So as much as we can identify them as we go through the process, the easier they will be to at least mitigate as we go through. But here again, it's a new journey. It's a new evolution in our work, and we're asking that same question for the very same reasons that you brought forward.
All right, we have a question from a data scientist in pharmaceutical biotech industry.
Hello, thanks again for being on the panel. So I have two questions. One is more for Rodrigo, and the other is more general question. So the first question for Rodrigo is, if you could just go into a little bit more detail with the question that Paul asked earlier about who are the people who are leveraging this as an opportunity for investment. So for example, who are the people who generally had access to already other kinds of companies and nonprofits to invest as individuals? What do they look like demographically, and how has your platform transformed that to include women per se or people of color and other people, especially since a lot of what you're talking about is involved at the neighborhood level and a lot of poverty is already concentrated. So I just would love some context on that. And if you'd like, I'd follow up with the second question now or ask right after.
I can speak to that one. Yeah, so first of all, so there isn't great sort of information on who the current holders of municipal bonds are, besides by tax bracket and income level. But what I can say is that the ownership of municipal bonds has become increasingly concentrated, in the richest 1% of households. It hit the kind of press that I read headlines a few times recently. The very prominent Republican congressmen and senators had huge municipal bond portfolios, which I think speaks to the fact that if you're somebody who's connected and has significant resources, there is a good chance you're in this asset class already. To the folks that we're trying to reach, We've sort of published some statistics about the folks who've kind of joined the platform up to now. There's about 12,000-ish people who've joined. We have a pretty broad spread of ages and genders. We don't collect demographic information sort of around ethnicity or anything like that or multilingual currently. I think for us, the key piece around access is the denomination. So conventionally, municipal bonds are denominated at $5,000, which for a single investment immediately puts it out of the hands of most people. And a couple of weeks ago, we did an issuance with the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the denomination was $1,000, which we saw as big progress. We would like to go much further than that. There are some institutional hurdles, but what really is to stop the market from supporting $10 bonds or $50 bonds? We really think that's where this should be going, because these investments are based around the taxes that we all pay, and they should be more accessible. And I think over the coming months, we are very interested in, is the access that we're aiming to provide, are we being successful? We're planning to do sort of more surveys of our users to try and get a sense of how people are participating. But I think what we saw from the Cambridge issuance that was really heartwarming, and we're going to be sort of publicizing this a little bit more in the next couple of weeks, is the sheer spread of folks who are participating. We had 22-year-olds up to 90-year-olds. We had a large number of people who'd never invested in bonds before. From our city sort of town hall meetings that we held, very good sort of diverse representation across gender, many people of color who said they'd never been to city hall before or participating. So the early signs are good. We don't yet have really comprehensive metrics, but that's where we want to get to.
Thank you. So the more general question is about the 2050 goal, right? So as you've stated before, there are companies and organizations before you that have already proven out this concept of ESG as not being diametrically opposed to being able to outperform the rest of the market. So because there is proof already, I'm wondering what else needs to happen for there to actually be this incremental change toward seeing ESG and impact investing as just investing. We're in this room, as the woman before me has spoken, because we're interested, right? And a lot of the thing that I keep hearing from you is talk to your financial advisor. So I know that from a standpoint of not being able to market to them directly, but there still seems to be a lot of opportunity that comes from the financial advisor perspective, especially since a lot of studies, including those that I have done experiments on how people operate in general, is most people aren't going to be active about their 401ks. They're do whatever is default, whatever the standard mutual fund or 401k presentation offers. So I'm just wondering, how can we make this the default since most people aren't going to make a change like we are? If you could speak to that, that would be really helpful.
Great. Excellent question. So.
Sure, I'll dive in just a little bit. I think that's a question that we're all struggling with, and there are a lot of different gatekeepers in the process, whether it's the financial advisor or what are at least perceived to be limitations of ESG options, sustainable investing options. A lot of managers just don't know the full range of what's out there, and for the largest pools of money, which really are the public pension funds, the sovereign wealth funds, a lot of them have increasingly shifted towards index investing, so essentially just buying the whole stock market, but gone so far in that direction, because index investing on average is shown to outperform, that now essentially they just want their money managers to manage exactly as the index performs. And they have what's called tracking error, which is essentially the deviation relative to how that benchmark index is performing, whether it's the S&P 500 or the MSCI All World Index is another common one. Various big institutional investors have their own index benchmarks, and they'll give their portfolio managers tracking error targets to essentially stay very, very close to how that index is performing. And if one of their portfolio managers is deviating from those tracking error targets, which everything that we're doing has substantial tracking error relative to what a benchmark is doing, because we're fundamentally investing in what we think are different and better companies, bonds, et cetera, that can make it challenging for these large pools of institutional capital to actually shift, because their portfolio managers aren't actually incentivized to shift. And a lot of that is also just changing the culture. We're at this point right now where the UN Principle on Responsible Investing has over 60 trillion signed on globally, saying that in the broad sense, it's shifting towards more sustainable investment options. But we still have a huge gap to close between rhetoric that, hey, we want to do this, and the actual movement of money. So that's something that we're all constantly working on.
Yeah, this talk versus action. Rodrigo, have you found any keywords that attract people versus repel people?
I think, are you talking about individuals here or sort of institutions?
What gets the lizard brain to do something? To either run away from the good or run towards the good or run away from the bad? What's the emotional, visceral hook?
I think it's about tangibility and about relevance. So, you know, everyone's an individual and they have their own sort of sense of what impact is to them. So can you make it clear that the impact you can have is tangible and is relevant to you? Is it in a field that you understand? And that requires a much more kind of like nuanced approach, I think.
Okay.
I don't know if that was dodging the question. But.
A little bit, but but Rodrigo has done testing on what words rouse the antibodies locally, like around government or bonds,
and
And then what attract local investing or invest in your community. Or we have started a hashtag March with your money. So, all right, this will be the last question before we close, and then we have the opportunity to be together. Yes, last question.
Great. This is a terrific panel. Thank you all for coming. I'm also a true believer in this and spend my days doing this, but I have a very specific question. I've been having this debate with our financial advisor for a decade and with no progress. So the idea that all this stuff is available to everybody is probably not we're not there yet.
Excluding the people in this room. And why do you continue with the same advisor?
Well, my question is where is there a catalog of this that I can either access myself or point my investment manager toward? I mean, and this is great. You know, I'd love to take advantage of a couple of these platforms with our own small dollar investments, but how can I see the full spectrum?
Yeah, so resources include, there's a group, there's a sustainable investing trade group called USCIF, the United States Sustainable Investing Foundation. So that's at uscif.org, and there might be a hyphen between US and CIF. So U.S. Sustainable Investing Foundation, and there's one for Europe and one for Africa and one for Asia. A second, if you want to focus on funds that have public equity funds, there's something called socialfunds.org, socialfunds.org. And then, fortunately, some of the larger brands have begun publishing. So Morgan Stanley has something called the Institute for Impact Investing. And they have at least three academic-like papers that they've pulled together to show that stocks and funds, in general, that perform well on sustainability or environmental social governance, ESG, are lower risk about 80 to 90% of the time and are higher return about two-thirds of the time. And again, past performance is not indicative of future results. But all the metrics that we have today from Morningstar analyze past performance. And so when you're picking a four-star or a five-star Morningstar fund, you're saying they've done well the past 3 or 5 years compared to peers. But the past 3 to 4 years, oil and gas companies have lost money. And so your Morningstar on an energy sector fund from 4 years ago would not be a good predictor. So that's a range of resources. Oxford University has pulled together a meta study of at first 200 and now 2,000 academic studies. And so on the USCIF, most of the USCIF.org site, most of these are listed. So there's no lack of academic evidence, market performance, and leaders, some of whom you've heard from tonight, to show you can do it. So it's not a technical reason, it's a human nature reason. And so sometimes we talk about financial advisors and human nature in general. We have to unlearn what we think we know. And so part of this is part of our work, and I think several of us here, you know, will lecture at universities to train the next generation of students studying finance at Presidio Graduate School, which is best MBA to change the world, and Stanford and Berkeley and Harvard, where there are groups around this, to say, one, this exists. Two, you can do this in your own portfolio. And actually, student investment portfolios are doing this as well. So those are some resources. There's additional links, I think, on all of our websites at Neighborly and Etho and Heifer and Hip Investor. So check those out or let us know. You want to squeeze in a question? Or?
Yes, thank you. This question is for Rodrigo, for Neighborly. This is a follow-on question regarding being able to invest in municipal bonds, especially on the lower denomination. Has there been any work in terms of securitizing your municipal bonds in an ETF or a muni bond fund to make it more accessible for all investors? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a topic that's come up a number of times since we began at the company. We haven't made sort of active steps in that area yet, but we're very interested in the separately managed account model and sort of derivations of that. And I think as denominations come down, creating these funds is going to become increasingly easy. You know, our view is that in a market where the last significant innovation was Excel, incremental change is not really going to work. So we didn't want to just recreate another muni bond fund with the same issues around fees and so on. We really felt like we needed to show that it could be done completely differently, direct to retail at a low denomination. I think it's very possible we would come back to something like a fund at some point, but you can imagine, you know, 2.5-3 years ago, many people looked at us like we were crazy to think that the City of Cambridge could issue bonds direct to the residents, and you know, now we're going to be doing it in a number of cities. But that really needed to be proven out as kind of a theme that Paul brought up. A lot of the issues in these markets and in action or the lack of action, it's really a human issue. It's people thinking it probably can't be done. There are very few technical barriers. And the way to show that it can be done is not to, you know, in my view, to beat people over the head with statistics, but actually go out there and create the case studies and show, you know, it has been done. And that makes it easier for people to get on board. You don't need to win the argument. You just give them something to get on board with.
All right, so we're going to close, and we're going to close with this. Panel, what is your tweetable summary? What is your 140-character or In the old days, my manager said, write billboards. So what's the billboard or tweet you want to leave us with as we close?
I'm going to give you two. One directed to that question, which is, if your advisor says it can't be done, find a new advisor.
Okay, great.
And the second is, sustainability is profitable for people, the planet, and your portfolio.
Great. Good billboard, good tweet. Ardith, Rodrigo?
Yeah. Tweets are not my thing.
Billboards.
There you go. Together, we can change the dynamics of how we invest for social change.
Great. That was a fantastic tweet. Rodrigo?
Let's see. Yeah, this is a really tough one. I would say invest intentionally. Invest in the things that you support.
Great. And I'll sign off by saying, it's your money, vote with it, and march with it.
Great. Again, I want to thank Paul Herman, Ardith Neal, Rodrigo Davies, and Ian Monroe for their comments here today. We have two more programs on impact investing this month on March 21, and then Paul Herman again with a different panel on March 30th. In addition, we have a book signing tonight with Paul Herman's book, The Hip Investor, Human Impact and Profit, Making Bigger Profit by Building a Better World. The panelists will be around for a few more minutes. Please stay around. We want to thank our audiences here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.